from 1998.
Sure.
So now I'm worried that I know JavaScript from like the, you know, the early 2000s.
Yeah, well, I think one of the amazing things for JavaScript is that the language itself, for instance, hadn't really changed for about 10 years. From about 99 through 2009, there'd been no changes at all in the language.
Mm-hmm.
For the first time in 2009, there were actually some changes to the JavaScript language, part of ECMAScript 5 in the standards world.
Mm-hmm.
And those changes are things which we've now integrated into the web platform. And so part of what I'm going to be talking about is about that. But I think also one of the other aspects of modern JavaScript is just that it's fast, right? It used to be that JavaScript was slow. Now JavaScript is fast. And as soon as it's fast, that changes a lot of the rules of, you know, where JavaScript can be used, you know, how computationally heavy tasks you can do. And so I think that changes a lot of things about how we think about JavaScript in our application platforms. And the last piece is just that JavaScript is now available across a much broader range of platforms. I think you showed this morning in your talk.
Yeah.
I'm going to go into a few more examples this afternoon in my talk as well. I think we've seen that JavaScript now is available, you know, both on the web, but then also inside many of our rich application platforms, and also now on the server side with Node. So that's kind of exciting and changes how people think about JavaScript as well.
Let's talk a little bit about this kind of renaissance, because you've got
Sure.
this language that was kind of invented, it became ubiquitous, but it became ubiquitous in a kind of alert,
Sure.
just, you know, forms validation kind of a way.
Yep.
And then it had this kind of upswing in 2009. And you said the upswing was kind of a couple things. It was a change in the language,
yeah.
its abilities. It is now able to do things it could not do before.
Yep.
And then there's a performance thing. Let's talk about those. This change in language, what caused that? I mean, you guys are meeting, an ECMAScript
Sure.
meeting. Are you in those meetings?
Yes, yeah.
So how does that work? Just a bunch of nerds in a room? Or how does a standards group make that happen?
Yes, I mean, I think for a long period of time, there was an attempt to make some progress in the JavaScript language. With ECMAScript 4. So ECMAScript 4 was worked on for several years in the 2000s. And ultimately, it sort of moved far enough away from where the web as we know it was at the time and is still today, that was not ultimately standardized. And so then sort of went back to square one. And ECMAScript 5 was a more incremental update, but it is something that's definitely driven by, you know, you've got representatives there from all the major browsers, plus folks who are just interested parties from other perspectives. And the group is working ultimately to make JavaScript a better language for the enormously broad set of users and use cases that it has. But that is, you know, everyone's bringing different perspectives, so it is a sort of committee environment. Mm-hmm. It has the pluses and minuses of that, but ultimately if we can move the JavaScript language forward, that can have an enormous impact, obviously, because it does affect so many developers.
Did someone come around in 2009 with an idea? You can say, oh, it was Fred's idea. Or was it a happening that was like groupthink and we all had the same idea around the same time?
I think it was probably about 2007 that there was the shift from thinking about it as being ECMAScript 4 and there was a big set of features that was being considered there, and saying, no, we want to do something more incremental, more focused on what the web really is, the kind of libraries that we were saying. And by that point in time, the sort of Ajax revolution, which sort of began some of this JavaScript renaissance, was already in sort of full swing. And so I think they were seeing that JavaScript was already gaining a lot more momentum, and that was based on the existing libraries, not on some very different take. And so I think it wasn't one person. I think it was, you know, Microsoft obviously felt that ECMAScript 4 was not the right approach to go for the standard, and really did advocate for this more incremental approach at the time. But it was, there were people from many of the different browser vendors who sort of saw that as the better path forward.
Mm-hmm. When you're on a thing like this, and I've done standards committees, but I've done them in the financial services space.
Sure.
I was on like the OFX committee,
yep.
which worked with like Quicken and Money and things like that. And there were some times when I was representing the company and I would want features in the spec because I knew that it would help us. Not in like a secret, sneaky kind of way,
yep.
but more in a, I really think that this would be a neat use case.
Sure. Yeah, I think one of the things that all of the different people who participate in the standards body bring is they bring a perspective that comes from the organization that they're part of, the set of users they talk to, the set of scenarios that they are sort of have in mind. And so I think obviously, you know, coming from working at Microsoft and representing Microsoft in the standards body, you know, my knowledge is based on, you know, I work with the Windows team on the Windows 8 app platform. I have knowledge of that. If I see a place where, you know, something in JavaScript can benefit the Windows app platform, that's something I'm going to make that connection, and we're going to talk about that. But it's never, like you said, it's never a sort of sneaky behind closed doors things. It's always I'm representing a set of use cases, a set of users, a set of reasons why we might want this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have an open discussion about, you know, what makes sense to address those. But same thing goes for folks from Google, Apple, Mozilla.
Mm-hmm.
They're all representing interesting use cases that are different sometimes from the ones that we as Microsoft would be bringing into the into the committee.
Okay. So it's sounds like it's a committee, but it's not necessarily political, where there's like backdoor dealings. Like, yeah, you can get this in, and we'll get that in.
I've been working in the committee for a little over about a year and a half or so, and I, you know, the politics aren't really a big deal in you know, for the folks who are sitting in the room. The politics of the committee really isn't a big deal. It does mean, you know, when you have a committee, you have a lot of different perspectives. That does make it harder to make progress than if you have a bunch of people who have, you know, all work at one company sitting mm-hmm. in a room, and they can sometimes move things faster than a committee can. But at the same time, the committee can make sure to be more intentional in its moves and represent a broader set of constituencies. And
okay, so then this committee kind of ratifies or starts ratifying ECMAScript. Sure. What status is ECMAScript in now? And ECMA, yeah. When we say ECMA, we're saying ECMA script.
Yeah, sure, we should have talked about that. So ECMAScript is obviously the standard that JavaScript implementations are based upon. So it's just the name of the standards organization. ECMA is the standards organization. ECMAScript is the name of...
So what's the one, when I have like, you know, Chrome 29 and IE10, and what ECMAScript do I have?
So all the browsers right now implement ECMAScript 5, which was the version ratified in 2009. And ECMAScript 5 was this incremental version. It wasn't until about IE10 is the first version of IE where we have the full implementation of ECMAScript 5. We had most of it in IE9.
Okay.
Similar for the other browsers, it wasn't until through the last 6 months or so that all the browsers really had correct implementations
really?
Of the full
that
thing.
Recent.
So it's taken some time to get all that support into all the browsers. But it also happens in incremental ways. So we see some of the features coming in earlier across browsers and then others taking longer.
Mm-hmm.
So for instance, the one feature of ECMAScript 5 that was new in IE10 is strict mode. And that was a feature which many of the browsers implemented slightly later. But that feature is something that now is available in all of the browsers that support ECMAScript 5.
Mm-hmm. So this implementation of ECMAScript has been happening. What then caused the performance kind of revolution after the language renaissance?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that was more amazing. I mean, so JavaScript had historically, in dynamic languages, one class of dynamic languages had broadly been viewed as being just a lot slower. That they, you know, the specs and the design of language were sort of oriented around being interpreted, and interpreters tend to be quite a bit slower, having a layer of abstraction there. And I think there was a set of languages from, you know, back in probably in the 80s even that had been doing fast interpreted languages, things like Self. And I think some of the folks who had been involved in those efforts started to realize that JavaScript was available everywhere, was a really good target for actually trying to take the knowledge they had from some of those other programming languages which were less prolific.
Mm-hmm.
And bring it and apply it to something which is going to be used by a lot of people. And so as we started seeing some of those folks with those skills come in, there started to sort of be a bit of an arms race.
Well, they discovered the problem. They're like, wait a second, there's a difficult problem that involves compilers and JITting?
Exactly.
I know that.
And I think when you apply some of the people who, you know, really know how to solve these problems to it, they found that they could make enormous improvements. And we've seen, just in IE, for instance, between 2001 and 2011, JavaScript performance is up, you know, depending on your benchmark, something between 20 and 100x.
Wow.
I mean, so that's absolutely enormous. That's way beyond Moore's law. That's way beyond
two orders of magnitude. Right?
Yeah. So that's really huge changes in performance. And when you have that kind of change in performance, it forces you to rethink what you can do with JavaScript.
So this morning in my talk, I gave a talk that was called Angle Brackets and Curly Braces.
Yes.
I didn't say which kind of angle brackets and which kind of curly braces, but it's kind of implied that I'm talking about HTML and XAML, and I'm talking about C# and JavaScript.
Yep.
And my general kind of postulate is, if you know an angle bracket or curly brace related language or two, you're probably in a good position as a developer. That was kind of one postulate. And the other one was that, I think that, you know, ASP.NET is great. I think that there's a virtual machine that we're not using, not utilizing. We've got infinite number on the server and plus one.
Yep.
Do you think that's a reasonable posture? Because you weren't there to vet my.
No. Well, I saw your talk at the conference earlier this month. But I think I think that the JavaScript runtime is now a very capable computational engine that any app should be thinking about how it leverages that as part of the overall application. And you're right that most websites, even many apps, aren't heavily leveraging. The compute they can get out
it's
of
it. It's an asset. It's a compute node that's just not being used.
Yeah, and in fact, you know, these days, one of the things that I'll be talking about is, you know, we have web workers now in IE10. And they're in many of the other major browsers.
Explain what that means to
So web workers, web workers are the ability to actually have multiple threads of execution in your website on the client. And so now, instead of just, you know, in JavaScript historically, mm-hmm. You just have a single thread of execution. Everything runs on that thread, and right. so you have to be really careful about how you use it. And I think one of the things that having that single thread meant that if you wanted to do a lot of compute-intensive work, you had to be really careful about how you did it, because you don't want to block the UI thread and prevent a user from interacting.
Well, that's my question. Is this going to be sluggish? Because you're making me, I mean, I've got 20 years of mental web yeah. baggage behind me. I'm like, oh, you're going to make my website slow, aren't you?
Well, that is a reasonable concern. Even once the engine is fast, that doesn't mean you can just sit there and do a second worth of compute on it, because that's going to block the whole UI is going to freeze for a second. And so the thing that web workers do, which I think is really exciting, is they mean that not only is the engine fast, but I can offload some of that work off of the UI thread onto other threads of execution, and then I can really do heavy compute. I can just do solid number crunching on my background thread if I want, and that's going to use up a core on the client's machine, but it's mm-hmm. not going to block their UI. And so I think that's exciting in terms of how it takes the performance benefits and enables them to really be the sort of this realization of what you're describing as the compute node, extra compute node that you've right. got on the client.
In my mind, I imagine a slider bar, because I'm a simpleton, and I think though that somehow people kind of go, it's all angle brackets generated on the server, yep. kind of classic 2001 era web forms, or it's Gmail.
Yeah.
And there's no middle ground. And some people came up afterwards and they're like, oh, you want me to stop doing this and go all the way over here?
Sure.
And I was trying, I hope I succeeded, and I think I hope you agree, to find that every application is different, and you have to find yeah. that place in the slider bar for you.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we've seen lots of stories over the last year. Definitely there's been more of a push, I guess, recently, there's been more buzz around the idea of apps which have very little on the server, where they are actually, they just have a service on the server. They're not producing HTML, they're producing JSON and then rendering it into things on the client.
Right.
And there's been buzz around that model, but I think in practice, everyone who's building anything of significant scale is indeed finding a spot in the middle. No one's going all the way to one end or all the way to the other end these days.
Well, Twitter seems to be going back and forth.
Well, Twitter has
What's
gone back
about?
And forth, yeah. Well, I don't know. I saw some of those guys do a talk on that, and they talked a little bit about some of the things. But I think, in a sense, one of the takeaways I took from the talk they did was exactly what you're saying, that ultimately there is the slider, but neither of the extremes is good. You have to figure out for your app, for the details of kind of the user experience you want to provide and what the performance characteristics of that and the network latency characteristics of that are, where you put that line, and I think that is going to be different. I don't think anyone's figured out the ultimate app pattern for where you put that.
Well, the web is young, as old as it is.
It is, yeah.
Now, we've got a number of folks that are up on the site right now, and you're putting in questions. I would encourage you not just to participate by putting in the questions that we've got on the big board, and then we're going to go through, but also to tweet and Facebook ch9.ms and let other people know that you're watching our show.
Yep.
So, interesting question here from someone identified only as H.
Yes.
Nice, right-in-your-face question. Why would anyone use JavaScript anywhere but a browser? Why would I want to do this on the server side?
Sure. Obviously C# is great, and if you want to use C# on the server, you can. And so no one's telling you have to go and use JavaScript instead. But I think what ends up happening is that there's a lot of developers who want to use JavaScript on the server, and I think that's for several reasons. One is that there's a lot of people out there with JavaScript development skills. There's a lot of people who grew up around the web who, you know, pretty much any developer these days has to know some JavaScript, and then they know some other set of languages as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so because they have that skill, bringing that into other environments where they're writing code is just something that's a skills reuse question. That's a valuable proposition right there. I think there's also a lot of interesting scenarios around reuse of code across the client and server. So there are some interesting scenarios you can get into with something like Node.
Sure.
Where
people say that, but what am I really reusing other than view models, maybe?
Yeah. I've seen some folks like some folks at Yahoo have talked. Doug Crockford's talked in the past about some approaches that they take where they actually do pre-rendering of. They basically use a fake version of the DOM on the server, and then they pre-render their templates into that fake DOM, and then the HTML that they send down is actually the exact same template rendering engine as they're going to run on the client, but they can run that on the server as well. And so those kinds of things where you're leveraging the fact that you've got the same code on both sides to make sure that
yeah.
any place where you're going to be doing some work on the server and some work on the client, and you want to be able to
right.
do those sort of, you want to be able to mix and match.
Well, that's an interesting example of the slider bar thing, because you're saying, I'm going to render a table,
yeah.
but I want it to show up in SEO, and I want the search engine spider to see it, so I'm going to render that on the first page.
Yeah.
Make a get, see the thing that was rendered on the server using a template. But then I ship that same template to the client and on subsequent calls.
And so when the user's now interacting with that page, now they don't have to come back to the server necessarily for a lot of those requests. So I think there are interesting scenarios like that that motivate having the same code on both. But there's also, you know, there's a ton of JavaScript libraries out there. There's JavaScript code that can do a lot of stuff, right? And just because of that, because of the amount of JavaScript code, the amount of help and documentation and things there are about JavaScript out on the web, that brings a lot of assets that can be leveraged other places. So I think the ultimate answer there is, you know, JavaScript doesn't have to be for everyone. JavaScript on the server certainly doesn't have to be for everyone, but it is something that I think there's definitely a community that is interested in kind of trying to move that forward. And that
so you don't think that .NET people shouldn't feel threatened by this?
No,
they
not at
learn
all.
More
not
than
all.
Just alert.
You know, .NET is fantastic on the server, absolutely. I mean, we've seen enormous and really powerful things built with .NET on the server. I think JavaScript on the server is a much newer thing as well. And I think there's going to be a bunch of interesting learnings. Node's been the first really successful tool there. I think it'll be interesting to see what happens with JavaScript on the server, but I don't think I don't think the trend yet is telling anyone, the Ruby guys don't need to be scared, the .NET guys don't need to be scared.
Should I feel like I need to pick a language? I mean, I was talking with Herb Sutter, the guy from C++, a little while back about how some companies seem to pick a language, Apple might pick one language, Google might pick three. Microsoft traditionally has really liked languages, and they have a lot of different fingers in a lot of different places. It all eventually comes down to C++ at some point.
Yeah, there's a lot of C++.
You know, I've met a number of people who advocate for being a polyglot programmer.
Yeah. Well, I think absolutely developers do not have to choose one language. And in fact, they probably shouldn't. If you only know one language, you're going to be severely limited in terms of kind of how broadly you can apply your skills. But I think at the same time, there are some languages which can be used in several places. And one of the things that's been exciting about JavaScript over the last 5 years has been that the number of places it can be applied has increased. So if you know JavaScript, that does give you skills which can be used in a number of places. And I think that is exciting to see. We saw attempts at this with Java back in the 90s, and that actually moved things forward further than we'd seen before that, certainly.
It certainly made the point, in not just a theoretical, but a very concrete way.
But I think now we're seeing, in a sense, some of the claims that were being made about Java back in the 90s about being this language that could really be applied broadly. JavaScript's getting a little bit closer to those, though I think, no language is ever going to be the ultimate, replace everything kind of language. And like you said, everything, everything comes down to C++ in the end and native code. So if you're trying to build the most performant, the best app, C++ is still going to be the thing where you're going to go.
Indeed. There are a number of questions from TypeScript. I don't want to spend too much time on TypeScript because we've got Anders doing some streaming and stuff like that. Yep. But very, very briefly, TypeScript.
Yeah.
Do you think it fits into the ecosystem of languages that compile or transpile into JavaScript?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's one of the particularly notable things about JavaScript is that obviously on the web, it's the only language for client-side scripting on the web that's built into every browser. And so that means that there's a lot of people don't get the choice on the client necessarily to use C# or Java or JavaScript. And so I think for TypeScript, I think TypeScript is one of a number of tools which can target JavaScript and can give folks familiar with other environments or with the kind of tools experience they can get in other environments, give them something which they can use when they're building against the JavaScript platform. I think TypeScript's obviously very exciting. I've been one of the people helping on working on that, and I think it's a great thing to do. I think the fact that we're aligning it with the standards as well, where the standards are planning on going with ECMAScript 6.
Right, you're almost giving us ECMAScript 6 like features early, like a preview of like if it were to be done like this, it might look kind of like TypeScript.
Yeah, well, I mean, we've very much aligned with where I work on both the ECMAScript standards body and then also on the TypeScript group, and so we're making sure that those things are aligned in terms of having the places where TypeScript is doing something that ECMAScript 6 is considering as well, and it may ultimately be part of JavaScript language that developers get to see everywhere.
Right.
That we give them that same capability in TypeScript. So I think there's a few reasons why that's exciting, but generally I think it points to the need for TypeScript comes out of the fact that people are building enormous JavaScript applications.
Right.
I think that's exciting to see in its own right.
It's hard to manage many, many thousands of lines of JavaScript.
Well, hundreds of thousands of lines in some of these cases.
Indeed. Yeah. So this idea of TypeScript kind of, is it, what's the difference between compiling, very briefly, compiling and transpiling? Have you heard that term?
Transformation/compilation? I think transpiling was a term that was made up.
Word,
I don't think it means anything particularly different.
I think
than
of a transformation,
compiling.
Not yeah. quite a compiler, because I don't think of TypeScript as compiling to JavaScript.
Yeah, I guess it depends on your definition of compiling at the end of the day. But yeah, it's it is much much lighter weight compilation.
Yeah.
I think it feels more like it's just sort of a slight change, you know,
right.
erasing a few things and rewriting a few things, but it doesn't feel like it's mm-hmm. doesn't feel like you're going
yes.
from, you know, C# to bytecode.
Certainly it's happening. That's happening underneath.
Yeah.
Certainly there's an abstract syntax
yep.
tree and compilation is occurring. But an interesting question here from Brian Jimdar, who is saying that some people have stated that JavaScript might be the assembly or the x86 of the internet.
Yep.
Is it reasonable to think of JavaScript as a compiler target?
I think it is, and I think we've seen a lot of sort of supporting evidence for JavaScript as a compiler target. I mean, TypeScript obviously is trying to do that. CoffeeScript has been very successful for being a very thin layer over JavaScript that just gives some syntactic conveniences.
Mm-hmm.
But we've also seen at the other end of the spectrum some really exciting kind of projects. Like Mscripten, which compiles C++ to JavaScript.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's
wow.
using more this notion of JavaScript being an x86 sort of thing. It's really compiling to a very low-level representation. It's only using about a dozen features of JavaScript, right? It's very thin profile.
But is there any awareness on the part of the ECMAScript committee that, like,
yeah,
people
absolutely.
Are doing this, so why don't we have this smaller version of JavaScript that's just these six operations, like RISC versus CIS kind of a thing?
I don't think it's likely that JavaScript would ever get smaller. I mean, backwards compatibility and all these things are incredibly important on the web, and so I don't think anything's going to get removed. But for the purposes of being a good compiler target, that doesn't really have to happen. You just have to have the right primitives be available there, and compilers can choose to just target those. I think we've seen things like Mscripten and various other tools have leveraged, for instance, typed arrays, which is something that the ECMAScript committee has been involved with
right.
as well. Those are a really powerful tool for doing sort of performant, low-level, byte-level manipulation, which is something that if you're really treating as an x86 kind of target,
right.
that you want to be working at that level of abstraction, not assuming that the JavaScript engine can figure it out from things at a higher level. And so many of the tools that are treating as x86, I think, are using some of these new concepts, which have been things which are heavily discussed in the ECMAScript standards body.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that JavaScript like engines can get any faster? Like for a couple of months there, it was like, okay, I get it. I've seen the SunSpider benchmarks were fast. I mean,
yeah.
is that really the thing that's making things a lot slower? I've talked to Steve Souders at Google about, you know, what the real issue is, and
yep.
so much more time is spent on the network than
yeah.
it is spending
well,
compiling JavaScript.
I mean, the time is spent in a whole bunch of different places, and the Internet Explorer team, for instance, spends a lot of its time when it's thinking about performance, just looking at the entire end picture, looking at the
right.
top 1,000 sites. What does the performance profile of this look like? And you know, JavaScript for some sites is a significant part of that. Mostly for apps and the kind of compute intensive things we're talking about. But definitely, the JavaScript engine performance is not the blocking factor for most of the websites that we use on a daily basis. Right?
Mm-hmm.
If I'm going to the New York Times, JavaScript performance is not what is causing that experience not to be the same as a fully native
mm-hmm.
experience. And so I think there's. There's definitely lots of other parts of the browser stack. There's the DOM
right.
performance, and we do a lot of work in the JavaScript engines on making sure that we're really close to the DOM so that those API calls are as fast as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Network is obviously a huge thing, and I think if we can do things in JavaScript language or the web platform to make module systems work, which allow the network to be used more intelligently by script, that's
right.
going to be something which can move that forward, and that's something that we're working on a bit in ECMAScript 6.
Do you work at all with Chakra, the engine? Are you allowed to
yeah.
speak to that? Because
sure.
A gentleman is asking the question that he doesn't like the garbage collection, the GC and the Chakra, and said that he'd love to have a compute node, but doesn't feel really comfortable with that JavaScript engine. That's not something I'm familiar with.
Sure. We definitely have. So this is about the Chakra GC on the. Well, so I guess
on
it's two different pieces. So the GC is definitely, the primary tuning target for the Chakra GC is, like we talked about, sort of the web as it exists today, right? And so a lot of the work we did in IE9, for instance, was around the web that exists and all the pages and making sure that we are really performant on the web that everyone's using. I think the areas of investment for the GC are likely going to be about the web as it's going to be, obviously, in the future and the kind of apps and things we'll see. And so I think there will be continued work, obviously, on all the GCs, as with every other component of the browser platform, to really tune for the kind of apps that start coming out and start pushing the bleeding edge.
So that's interesting. So let me see if I can parse that a little bit.
Okay.
I'm hearing you say that, and I understand that the Windows organization at Microsoft is very largely metrics focused. Like, for example, I was talking to Scott Gu about Azure, and I was saying, well, I want this feature, and I want that feature. And he's like, well, we actually have all this really interesting data that shows anonymized that people are using it this way. And even though you're a guy that thinks that's super important, it turns out that's the least used feature that we have, or whatever.
Sure.
And I heard you say top 1,000 websites. It's kind of a number to pick, right?
Yeah.
Top X.
I don't actually know what the number
it's
is
some
exactly,
number.
But it's a big number. Yeah.
Some number that's big that's X.
Yeah.
So you're basically saying that, like, hey, Hanselman.com, super slow. But that's like the millionth most popular website, so we're not going to tune this to that. But hey, you know, Yahoo and New York Times and MSN.com are consistently slow. We're going to tune for that. That's a different kind of tuning, a very situational tuning, than a theoretical, your GC doesn't work in this micro benchmark.
Yeah, well, I think there ends up being a bit of the both extremes. But I think, you know, we obviously think that the biggest value is going to come from looking at the real aggregate systems that people are using all the time. That's where, you know, that's where the exciting kind of things are, right? That's where if you can make an improvement that affects these top 1,000 websites, that's going to be a really significant benefit. But there's certainly a lot of, you know, the micro benchmarks and things, you know, those inevitably come up. You know, we do still run SunSpider in our performance labs, and we do still make sure that we're going to be fast on those. And I think that same thing is true in other subsystems. But generally, if we can move the actual performance of the web forward, that's something that we care more about at the end of the day. So
when I think about micro benchmarks and I think about some of the more theoretical things, it brings up computer science, which is a great question from Vivek, who's asking about, do you think this is something should be taught? I think that teaching JavaScript versus teaching Python or these things is perhaps more appropriate for computer science. But then maybe the larger question of the classical language versus the kind of prototypal language, maybe you could talk about what that means to the average computer scientist.
Sure. Well, I'll take the first part of that first, I guess. I do think we're seeing that JavaScript is increasingly being taught as a programming languages setting. It is, just as a raw programming language, it is quite an interesting environment for learning about programming languages. It has the combination of a very simple object model, and we'll get to the prototypal part of that in a second. But then that combined with what was I going to mention there? Oh, that combined with first-class functions, which the notion of having first-class functions in your language is a really powerful one. That's something that functional programming languages had sort of pushed for a long time. But having that plus a simple object model actually enables a ton of interesting developer patterns, and that's what sort of fueled a lot of JavaScript's growth. But I think from a purely sort of academic perspective and learning programming languages, thinking about the way that those two pieces combine is actually really nice for learning programming languages.
I wanted to know more about this idea. Like, people don't necessarily know. I mean, the difference between kind of a classical, kind of an object-oriented style, and some people believe that there's a generation of us that were taught OO patterns, and that has infected our minds.
Sure.
And it prevented us from being successful in prototypal or functional languages. Yep. That there is, most people think, well, I have for loops, I have an if, and I got this great switch statement. I'm a programmer.
Yeah, I think there's obviously a lot of different styles of how you develop code out there. No one of them is right. I think the OO model, as popularized by sort of design patterns revolution, that model was very successful. It led to a very broad set of large applications being built throughout the 90s that really moved forward productivity for all of us in a significant way. And those patterns are something that, you know, using core OO techniques that were available in a lot of languages, you were able to then go, and if you saw a problem, you were able to model out how to address that. I think we haven't yet seen that kind of thing appear based on other, like the prototypal system doesn't have as clear stories about how do I apply this in a consistent way. Like, there isn't the design patterns for prototypal inheritance that book that I know of. There might be one out there, but there's certainly nothing that's of the same kind of broad popularity as that was in the OO world. Prototypal inheritance is more primitive in a sense than OO as seen in C# and Java and things. And I think that more primitive nature has pluses and minuses. The plus is that it's very flexible. People can go and use it to develop all kinds of interesting object models. The prototypal plus dynamic nature of JavaScript has been one of the things which has made it really easy to sort of monkey patch objects and do interesting things with the DOM, which have fueled a lot of the interesting, like the fact that we can polyfill APIs, for instance.
Things that used to look like, we would always try to model the world, right? All through the 90s, it was like, model the world. Yep. Yes, everything derives from something. And, you know, there's like a book, and a book derives from object, and there's a librarian. Well, no, we're not going to do that. That's object-oriented. We'll do service-oriented. The book goes through the library and service, and and then, like, well, we'll monkey that, patch that. There's no reason that I can't just spot weld this function onto that.
Yep.
And we would struggle with this kind of cage we'd built for ourselves.
Yep. Yeah, and so I think, you know, I think that the cage is the negative at that end. The prototypal approach isn't nearly as prescriptive in a sense, right? It's that more raw form. And I think that means that people can do a lot of creative things with it, and they have done a lot of creative things with it. And the kinds of libraries that have been built in JavaScript are really interesting, expressive APIs.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, because it's more primitive, people end up trying to build patterns that they're familiar with, not just core OO patterns, but mix-in patterns, that kind of thing. Try to build them on top of it and end up actually programming to an abstraction that's above what the language itself is expressing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think because of that, that's part of why in ECMAScript 6, for instance, classes are being brought into ECMA, into the JavaScript language. But not classes as you're probably thinking of for Java or C#, not this heavyweight, very different thing, but really just taking the really standard JavaScript pattern of I have a constructor function and I have some methods on its prototype. And that's just a standard pattern for using the prototype to share methods across all the instances of a constructor. Taking that pattern and giving it a syntax, which makes it really easy to reason about, I am talking about a class here, I'm not just talking about a pattern, I'm talking about this pattern.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that kind of tool can help to sort of up-level the way that developers think about their code. They don't have to be thinking about these primitives and constantly redesigning the patterns that they use to build larger software. They can think to abstractions which are at the level that they kind of want to reason about.
Do you think that when ECMAScript 6 kind of starts happening and or the proliferation of TypeScript, that's when this theoretical patterns book will be written? Because I'm hearing that there's a lot of community knowledge about, like, well, this is just the way, you know, this, dot, that, and that, and then you use a variable called that, and that's just the pattern, because the croc says that's the pattern. And that's going to now get baked in. So there's some communal knowledge that's going to become a pattern.
I do think that one of the things that ECMAScript 6 is doing is taking a lot of the really common patterns and the kind of pain points around those patterns and trying to come up with ways to provide syntax around them. Classes is one like that. That pattern is something that you see in just about every code base that's over 100 lines of code in JavaScript is doing something like that class pattern. And so giving a syntax for that is convenient. But things like the var that equals this trick, for instance, that we're introducing arrow functions, which give you a way to... in ECMAScript 6, which give you a short function syntax which binds the lexical this, and so that avoids the need for some of those other patterns which are just these weird workarounds that everyone sort of, as you said, could communally agreed upon that we're going to use these funky workarounds.
Right.
But if we can make the language sort of evolve in a way that makes those less needed, that's a good thing.
Are there any other things in ECMAScript 6 that you're particularly excited about? I mean, I hear classes and I hear arrow functions.
I think the most exciting thing, but sort of the biggest thing and the thing that I think at the moment is still, you know, we've got to see whether we can get it all done in the time frame for ECMAScript 6. The really exciting thing I think is modules and modules as a sort of dynamic loading mechanism. And so there's been, AMD, the asynchronous module definition on the client, and CommonJS in Node on the server have really popularized some module loading patterns that allow you to be a lot more flexible in how and when you load code and how you load your dependencies, and you can pull on some code from here or from here, and depending on which you'll get different subsets of your code.
Mm-hmm.
Those kind of systems are still, you know, something you have to add on outside of the browser. But if we can do a module system inside JavaScript itself, that can give every developer the ability to do that in a way that isn't as sort of doesn't require some of the stepping through hoops that you have to with some of those systems, but just has simple baked-in syntax for doing modules. And I think that is one of the key pieces that the runtime is going to need to really be able to scale up well.
I remember reading something, I think it was on the IE blog, about performance, and it was saying that of the top X number, you know, 500, 2,000, something like that, websites, that something like 60 or 70% of the JavaScript that was being downloaded was never actually getting run.
Yep. Yeah.
And that is that a problem that modules could potentially help solve?
It's a problem that modules can help solve, certainly, if people use them. We've done a lot of things to help solve that problem, like, we, for instance, in in the Chakra engine, we do something called deferred parsing, which means that you maybe get all this script, but if you're only going to execute this amount of it, we don't want to spend the time parsing all of this stuff. Mm-hmm. And so we actually do just a quick parse to understand whether there's any errors that we need to report, but we don't actually do all the work of bringing into memory all the ASTs and all this stuff. And so we try to defer as much of that work as possible. And so we are doing things to mitigate those problems now in the engines, and so are some of the competitive engines. But I think that there's definitely... I think modules and things like that would definitely help solve that problem more mm-hmm. at the root, if people can use it.
A couple good questions here. One person is saying that, is JavaScript suitable for large-scale apps? That's kind of the question that was answered by TypeScript, is that at some point, some people believe, yeah. and some people disagree, that hundreds of thousands of lines of JavaScript is pretty difficult to refactor and to find one's way around. Other people and other tooling vendors might disagree.
Yeah, well, I think I'll say this. I've talked to a lot of teams, both inside Microsoft and outside Microsoft, who build apps in the 10,000 to over 100,000 line scale in JavaScript, and they use a plethora of different techniques for how they structure those. But I don't think I've seen one yet who uses just plain JavaScript. Pretty much everyone uses some set of additional either lint tools or other richer static analysis tools. Most of those involve at least putting some additional metadata in comments in their code that those tools can be driven off of. And so there's a whole bunch of different kinds of techniques people use for managing that complexity. Mm-hmm. But I think there is the need for some amount of extra stuff generally to be brought in. Luckily, there's a lot of different people building tools sure. that can help with that. And so people, there's a lot of options. I think TypeScript is one at one end, but there's a lot of other options there as well. So I think, you can build large JavaScript applications. People are doing it. People are being successful with it. Mm-hmm. I think there are still certain challenges there that aren't there for something like C#, where we have a really rich tooling environment.
I've even heard tales of people taking JavaScript and just renaming them .ts, making no changes, and then just using TypeScript as a lint tool.
Yeah. In a sense, you could think of TypeScript as a lint tool, right? Is probably its biggest actual... value proposition is as a very rich lint tool that's actually using all the static type information to fuel linting, whereas most traditional lint tools aren't leveraging that amount of information. Mm-hmm. And so I think the spectrum from raw style based lint tools all the way up to type system based static analysis tools, I think that's something that really there's been a lot of increased investment in over the last few years. And I think it's driven by the need to build these large applications. There's a lot of people now who want to do it, and so we've got to build the tools.
Question here. The person is saying that, is there really no other reason to use JavaScript on the server other than I like that language or I know that language? Are there particular functional or use cases you can think of where JavaScript is the best choice for the server?
I mentioned one of them, which is about sort of this code sharing aspect, which I think is a really significant one and is really sort of fundamental. That you're almost inevitably going to have a client that's got doing JavaScript, and especially if that client's doing something rich with mm-hmm. client-based templating, then there's opportunities to do a lot of interesting sharing there. But I think there's other things. I don't think there are quite as much about JavaScript itself as maybe. Specifically about something like Node.js, which is obviously the most popular JavaScript on the server solution today. It has a bunch of design philosophies around, being heavily async, for instance, right. at the core of its system. And those can have some really significant impacts on the way that you design applications in Node versus what you might do by default in other systems.
The eventing, so the non-blocking I/O.
Yeah, exactly.
Like
and all of that's possible on any platform, but any given platform is going to sort of suggest a different set of things. And so, for the set of apps, the set of things where that may be more important, Node may have some benefits. Most of that isn't directly about JavaScript itself, although JavaScript being a single-threaded language sort of forces you to think about non-blocking I/O. Hmm. But it is something that I think Node.js as a platform, irrespective of language, has various pluses and minuses against alternative server-side technologies, I think.
All right. Another question here. This is an interesting one. A person is asking about whether or not there should be a standard JavaScript bytecode. One of the great things about JavaScript is that you can view source on it.
Yes.
What if you just, zipped it up and called it bytecode?
Yeah, I this topic I think has come up a lot. I think it would be somewhat of a challenge for all the browser vendors to agree on what this bytecode should be. And I think that's for a set of good reasons that if you look at the performance gains, for instance, that have been had in JavaScript over the last 6-10 years, in a sense, if there'd been a bytecode model already, that stuff wouldn't have happened, right? We wouldn't have been able to see that kind of thing because the browsers wouldn't have been capable of making choices under the hood. They would have been much more constrained with that specific bytecode, that specific representation. And so I think the fact that that there's not a bytecode has actually allowed the engines to evolve much more aggressively and do a lot more under the hood. And we still see that some engines are taking quite different approaches to how they treat performance. And I think a single bytecode across all those might not be the right solution for the long term. But we'll see. I think none of these doors are closed for the future, and we'll see what the platform ends up needing as we move forward. It may be that's part of the solution.
Cool. Well, I'm pretty stoked that you're working on the team and that you're our advocate at the ECMAScript and also working on TypeScript. So thanks so much, Luke Hoban, for hanging out with us today. Thank you so much. Remember, you can go and check out TypeScript at typescriptlang.org. And be sure to tweet Facebook, G+, Yammer, Orkut, whatever you can, channel9, ch9.ms, and we'll be right back. Thanks so much.